The next case in our calendar is 96-838, 96-15-85. Mr. Sowen? Salon.
Please support, Your Honor. I'm going to have Mr.
Sir, Mr. Christopher. Thank you. Thank you.
May it please the Court, we would request about 5 minutes to set aside for rebuttal for Mr. Sowen, and we will be dividing for the other 10 minutes.
Okay. You'll need to watch your time on the clock there closely if you want to. Yep.
I'd like to start out by thanking the Court for recognizing the importance of the issues in this case and giving me the honor to appear here today to argue these issues. And very briefly, I'd like to look back to the case and see where the importance of the issues raised. My client was originally stopped in 1995 in Hancock County, Ohio. After some questioning, field strike in Tennessee, he was placed under arrest from MBI and was immediately placed under ALS suspension by the officer. He did file an appeal with the trial court. That suspension, that appeal was denied. I filed motions raising all the issues that are before the court today, as well as other issues, some of which were dealt with by the court ultimately justice. And those motions were denied after a no contest plea. My client took an appeal to the third district, which affirmed, and now we're here today. I would like to argue first my first proposition of law as set forth in my brief, and that deals with the officer's report being automatically admitted under 4511.191 at an ALS hearing. I believe that this provision is unconstitutional for several reasons. First of all, it's hearsay, that it's not capable of cross-examination, and I believe that the legislature's promulgation of this rule violates the separation of powers. Section 1, Article 4 of the Constitution states that this court assess what the practices and procedures, including the rules of evidence, are in the trial courts, and that all laws that are in conflict should be of no force, or in part of no force and effect. 4511.191 is in conflict with Rule 802, promulgated by this court, that prohibits hearsay, though it does allow exceptions to be made by the legislature. It also says that they should not conflict with this court's rules. And this section also conflicts with Rule 803 and 804. The statute mandates the admission of this report, even in the absence of the officer, to be admitted evidence, and also mandates the court treated as prima facie proof of the state's case in this ALS hearing, even though there's no cross-examination. The officer doesn't even have to appear. In fact, my experience has been, does not appear at these hearings. That leaves the defendant having the burden of proof, no way to refute it other than to take the stand itself, knowing, of course, that if he does so, he's giving up his right to remain silent, and his testimony will ultimately be used against him in the DUI case. I recognize fully that traditionally this court has treated the rules of evidence somewhat laxly in administrative hearings. However, this situation is different for several reasons. Specifically, unlike other administrative procedures like the Industrial Commission, this statute does not dispense with the rules of evidence. Though the statute obviously tries to make an end run around the hearsay rule, it does not specifically do away with the rules of evidence applying.
You conceded in your brief, haven't you, counsel, that this is an administrative proceeding where the rules of evidence may be relaxed?
This has been found by the court to be, I believe, an administrative proceeding, but it also differs from other administrative proceedings in this respect, and that is they have mandated the legislature that the courts, in effect, be the hearing officer, so they have moved the standard executive branch hearing officer type thing to putting it over onto a judicial officer. And it's this court's function.
Is that a bad thing?
It's not a bad thing, except for the fact that it's this court's function to decide how judicial officers conduct their hearings and under what rules, not the legislature's. And that's what they've done, is they've tried to get around the rules of this court of how the judiciary is run. And in so doing, in this statute, they have judicial officer and the parties to get the information for the judicial officer to weigh the credibility of the witness. There's no foundation requirements whatsoever. There's no way to judge the reliability of the evidence. All the traditional time-proven methods of weighing evidence have been eliminated by their actions of the statute. And even though this is a civil matter, they have, by setting the time period, making a mandatory time period, eliminated the accused person's ability to use the civil rules for such things as discovery. You don't have time in 5 days to get any discovery. You don't have time to take the deposition of the officer and use that deposition to counterbalance this automatically admissible warrant. So even though it's quasi-civil, the civil rules aren't available. There's no way available for the defendant, in effect, to test the credibility of this automatically admissible evidence. The legislature is obviously trying to remove, by doing this, trying to remove immediately not only drunk drivers, but suspected drunk drivers or accused drunk drivers from the roads, and that's not a bad thing. Safety and sometimes even retribution are proper and sometimes even necessary goals of the legislature. However, if we're going to be a state of people who live by a rule of law, then we must make sure that our system and all the cities have systems put justice first, and justice requires that there be some means available to test the evidence that's being presented against you.
Counsel, what's the scope of the ALS hearing?
The ALS hearing?
Yeah.
The scope of it is to determine, in effect, whether there's probable cause
for the arrest.
For the arrest. And the courts have also the ability to give occupation of driving privileges at the ALS.
So, the report suppose, can you even get into the mix of the question of limited driving privileges?
You can't get into the issue of limited driving privileges. In fact, my experience has been that at least on the first time offender, usually on the second, most trial courts will grant after a 15 to 30-day period occupation driving privileges. But that doesn't cure the problem unless your court is coming in subject to no rules. No way to test is for asking.
Well, there is a way. The report's really negative. Say on the if all you're after is the limited driving privileges, but the report says this citizen was abusive, tried to drive off on me, on and on and on, things that might typically make a judge less sympathetic. If you feel that's not the case, you can subpoena the officer.
Theoretically, you can, but as a practical matter, I think you read your statement, but as a practical matter, you've got a 5-day hearing. Usually, the court is going to set that hearing at your initial appearance, or more probably, they're going to send you a notice. So you're actually going to have 2 or 3 days to try to subpoena this officer as a practical matter. At least where I'm at, the officers are not in Harford County at the time of the case, and they're 1 or 2 counties away. You've got to get your subpoena served. It's not going to happen. You're going to have to ask for continuance, or is the court served?
Well, I mean, as a practical matter, the other way, I mean, normally, as you just indicated, if there isn't anything real negative along those lines, it's a first offense, the judge is going to grant some privileges.
As a first offense, but yeah. This rule covers all of it, whether it's a fifth offender, a tenth offender, or a first offender.
You refer to as a practical matter, getting that subpoena up, as a practical matter, to take it the other way, then every officer who writes a DUI up is going to have to show up in court, to show up at the continuances, and on and on and on.
Your Honor, in every other type of proceeding we have in court system, civil or criminal, the person testifies, submitting the evidence, has to testify to lay a foundation, be subject to cross-examination, whether it's a probable cause.
Ever get a speeding ticket?
if there's a trial, if there's a hearing.
If there's a trial.
If there is a contested hearing, they have to be there and are subject to the traditional rules of testimony and credibility. And this should be no different, especially when the changes aren't being made by the people, which is you, mandated by the Constitution to make those changes. If there's no other questions on this issue, I turn the time over to Mr. Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Christopher. Mr. Swan.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Justices and Chief Justice Moyer. I'm going to take about 3 minutes, and if I could just clarify one point. On that ALS form that Mr. Christopher was referring to, there's no notation of abusiveness of the condition of the defendant. The closest you get, Your Honor, is in the upper right-hand corner. It just says reasonable grounds for the initial stop. That's it. Just with that correction.
So that's the real harm then is that the officer's testimony that he saw weaving, he saw a taillight out, whatever it is that he uses as his basis for the stop, comes in with that.
Unchallenged. And the ramifications, of course, are potentially devastating. This dovetails into the issues that this court asked me to bring as it pertains to Mr. Kirby, and although the constitutional challenges that I raised were very similar to the challenges that Mr. Christopher raised, Mr. Kirby, unlike Mr. Christopher's client, is a multiple DUI driver. I believe it was for one. And this court specifically requested the impact of 4511.191, the implied consent statute, on Mr. Kirby. In this particular instance, it was necessary for Mr. Kirby to have his vehicle to drive. And here's where the impact comes, Your Honor.
That's where I really had trouble with your argument, because he wasn't permitted to drive anyway, and he was driving. His license had already been yanked. So what's he doing on the road? What's he arguing he needs to drive when it's already been yanked?
I believe, Your Honor, that Mr. Kirby did have occupational driving privileges at that point in time. As a multiple offender, I don't recall off the top of my head when his prior DUI occurred. I believe, in fact, Mr. Kirby had those occupational driving privileges. The issue, perhaps, is a little bit broader than that, Justice Stratton. And the problem here is he has got a necessity to continue his employment, and as evidenced in the transcript of a very brief testimony, Mr. Kirby, he did take a stand briefly. His work required him to go to the environs around Akron, where he lived, to Hudson, to Norton, to Barberton, outside of the Summit County area, and by this blanket taking, if you will, untested, no hearing, essentially no notice of his driving privileges, assuming Justice Stratton, in fact, properly had them or he had occupation.
I didn't see that anywhere in the recent statement to another license.
The point of fact, Your Honor, is there's no hearing to even reach that issue, whether he should have been driving or not. This is partial of the problem with Section 4511.191. He is now looking at a 3-year license suspension, as well as the other problems that he is a multiple convicted DUI offender will now face. This is precisely the problem with this statute as we see it. I know that this court has never found the right to drive to be a fundamental right that is significant as far as constitutional protections occur. This court, as the state's pointed out, as Mr. Christopher has pointed out, the Doyle versus BMV case, it's a privilege and not a right. I'd ask this court to maybe consider establishing a new category of privilege and that of a fundamental privilege. The point here is that Mr. Kirby and other people similarly situated are now in a position where, what are we supposed to do? They can't contest this suspension. They can't, for this practical matter, do anything other than go through the judicial process with minimal likelihood of success. And yet there is a terrific impact on their ability for instance, exercise their right to travel. We've argued it's a fundamental right to travel. Certainly, the Supreme Court of the United States has so held. We ask this court to reevaluate the process in which the licensees, Kirby's case, the occupational driving privileges, the privileges of any citizen of civil power taken, sort of scenario. There are any additional questions regarding this point?
Let's assume he even had occupation, which I don't see in the brief. Mm-hmm. He had one of those ignition protection devices,
yes,
and he had apparently bypassed it with an air compressor.
Those are the allegations.
Just the allegations. Were there findings on that in the trial court?
No, ma'am. In fact, it's sort of curious that he was able to do that. The officer asked him to blow into the ignition interlock based on the testimony that was presented, it would not start. And certainly, the question arises as to, and these are all unanswered questions. When did he start driving? Where was he coming from? Where was he going to? Why was he driving? Was the compressor itself working that the state intended allowed him to start the car? None of these questions are answered. Frankly, none of these questions are explored.
Thank you, Mr. Swan. Mr. Quinn.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Chuck Quinn. Please report, I represent the City of Akron in this matter. Mr. Kirby, I represent the area of Thin Lake in this prosecution. Nonetheless, I'd like to address just one small point. That was made, the assertion that no other hearings, there is such devastating hearsay evidence that is given in these ALS proceedings which rely on some sort of hearsay. I would refer the court to perhaps evidence rule 104, perhaps these rules of evidence do not apply in the first place to this type of hearing. In addition, I would note that the area of arrest rely hearsay evidence for the purpose of making arrests and form a complaint and affidavit. The area of search warrants where we enter people's homes, we routinely rely on hearsay evidence for a most devastating type of determination of seizing of people and places as opposed to the seizing of driving privileges.
When you say hearsay, in what respect?
As far as the affidavits, the rule 104 and rule 41, the criminal rule of each make determination based upon hearsay in part, provided that there is a criminal basis for belief in hearsay and that there is a basis in fact, deal with two-pronged test of Spinelli and Aguilar. We do rely on hearsay. In cases of bond, courts routinely rely on the hearsay reports that are presented to the court on what sort of bond we're going to actually hold on to a person and actually keep them in jail based on the basis of what is stated in those reports, whether they are past records, whether they show they are the nature of the evidence that will be presented ultimately against these people, showing the serious nature of the offenses. So the taking of this driving privilege is of far less consequence than other areas in which we rely on hearsay normally. I did not read these issues. I was requested by this court to read the three issues of, presented. One was the first is the equal protection of that. I'll state that to a certain extent, I don't know how this affects Mr. Kirby in the first place. He was sentenced based upon his convictions. And his appeal was taken from the conviction, administrative nature of his case. I'm not sure how it precedes this court. I understand that's sort of the order of the court to have me address, but I'm not sure how it precedes this court. He is sentenced to a substantial sentence. His license is suspended, had been suspended. Most of these issues are mooted at this point as it pertains to Mr. Kirby. His situation as he entered into this fray was believe that these issues are for all practical purposes mooted. Nonetheless, addressing myself to the argument of counsel that there is some sort of fundamental right to travel here associated with this case, I don't think so. There is nothing in any of the ALS provisions that prevents him from traveling. It prevents him from exercising privilege. That's what it prevents him from doing. That's privilege that's granted him by the state of Ohio. It takes with it a responsibility of how you use that privilege. And the legislature of the state of Ohio has recognized that over and over. When I first came into the business of prosecuting, I believe that the statutes of the state of Ohio as an impact on DUI were probably 4 or 5 pages long in total. Now we have about 20-some pages just on DUI, ALS, and suspensions. The legislature had been very active in this, very concerned about the problems with drunk driving. There is a rational basis for their concern. I believe that is the standard that should be addressed. There is no fundamental right in this case as far as travel. Counsel in his brief mentioned the problems of economic impact. I'm not sure that counsel has ever seriously suggested that the defendant is poverty stricken. Nonetheless, I don't believe this has anything to do with poverty. I don't think that anything this has to do with right to travel. I don't think that it has anything to do with urban or rural residents. I believe that the statute as written equally treats each person in the state of Ohio the same when they come to court having refused to either go into the machine or having had a specified blood alcohol content.
Does that take care of all the issues? All the other issues that you were asked brief. I know that the police report and hearsay is not your issue, but I wanted to let you argue your case and then get back to that because your practical experience could help us with that.
Well, I'll be glad to come back to that at this point. Everything else that
okay, that's what I thought too from your argument. You cite Rule 104. Rule 104 says preliminary questions concerning the qualification of a person to be a witness. That's not what we have here. The existence of a privilege, not what we have here. Or the admissibility of evidence shall be determined by the court, subject to the subdivision B, which I don't quite understand. In making its determination is not bound by the rules of evidence except those with respect to privileges. Does that mean, I guess I should ask, what does that mean? Particularly, shall be determined by the court, subject to subdivision B, the admissibility of evidence. Is that a preliminary question? Because it starts out preliminary questions. Is that a preliminary question on whether we're going to hear it, or is it the ultimate issue? Because clearly we've always found that those police reports are hearsay. We even redact a number of those, don't we, before they go to the jury in some cases. And I just want to know how the rule applies.
The question of whether something is hearsay or not, whether you redact them or whether they come in, they are hearsay. They're absolutely hearsay.
Yes, sir.
Without question, the question is whether they are admissible hearsay. And that is the
all right, well, if you concede they're hearsay, then you concede, would you concede that Rule 104 doesn't apply?
I'll be honest with the court, because I know their previous comments about honesty. I had not previously briefed this issue, as I recall, perhaps in the state of the rule, that the preliminary questions to the court, such issues as bond hearings and the like, perhaps I'm saying wrong with the rule.
No, well, that's the rule that's the closest, I think, to apply, and I'm wondering if the way it reads that almost all evidentiary questions. It almost looks like the trial court then wouldn't have to apply to any of the other rules on evidence, relevancy, 401 and 403. So I just wonder if it applies that way, or if you know in your experience, because, or is it just an initial determination and the ultimate determination of admissibility of the report is not covered under 104? And if you haven't looked at it, I'd understand.
I'm not going to try to adventure. I would say only this, is that when the treatment time does 5 days, the 5 days and the quickness of this and having these reports available, this type of procedure, this is a large part of my practical experience, due to the right of the defendant to get a quick hearing on these types of matters, to get in front of the court quickly. Counsel has made it sound like that this was set up as a penalty to the defendant. It hasn't been set up as a penalty to the defendant. It's been set up for the court in an expeditious manner in which the concerns of the defendant can be addressed in some way that give him some meaningful remedy. If we're talking about having a hearing 30 or 45 days down the road, well, he's 30 or 45 days without a license, and he has a real difficulty in not a venue in which to address his concern.
Is the ALS an adversary proceeding?
Yes, it is.
Because I was thinking maybe Rule 101, C7 might apply, special not adversary statutory proceedings, because it's clearly a statutory proceeding. Then the rules would not apply, be clearly inapplicable by their nature. How about 101A, these rules govern proceedings of the court subject to exceptions stated in Division C, and then it gets to admissibility determinations, prerequisite to rulings on the admissibility of evidence. Then it cites 104, so maybe it's preliminary to the ruling on whether or not the issue is hearsay, because it cites, it cross-references in 101 to 104.
I believe the court is correct in making that analysis.
Thank you.
Well, with that,
how do we get around the problem then? You know, as many of these cases as many of us have tried, we always worry about that police report coming in untested. That's why we always make the officer show up. What do we do here? I mean, clearly you're admitting a police report in this case.
In an administrative setting.
Without foundation, without corroboration or verification, simply accepting the report that you say you concede is hearsay.
It is hearsay. I'm not suggesting that I have the answer. I have not proved that issue.
Maybe what we could do is find an exception under the hearsay rule.
Excuse me?
Maybe we could find an exception under the hearsay rule.
Well, if I were given maybe an hour or so, I might be able to find one.
Okay.
Whether it is a business record of normally kept, whether it's considered that, whether it's considered the exceptions that would be otherwise available, whether or not the statute would be otherwise appropriate statutory adjustment to the rules of evidence. The rules of evidence are adjusted by way of statute privileges are established by statute. Other means of affecting the rules of evidence are statutorily provided. The 4511.19 itself talks about the rules of evidence being adjusted as far as the admissibility of a chemical test. So those go all within the framework of the rules of evidence. The assertion that the statute does not have an impact on the rules of evidence and that they have to be in complete conformity, I believe, is not true throughout our jurisprudence.
Counsel, do you agree with the appellants that if there's a conflict, that the rules of evidence control the statute?
If there is a conflict, if there is a direct conflict, I would suggest that would be correct. I don't think there is a conflict, though.
Isn't that sort of the threshold of the appellant's argument? They are in the direct conflict.
I understand that that's their thrust in a criminal case, as opposed to an administrative setting. They may have a point, but I don't believe that would pertain in the administrative setting.
The reason I asked you about the administrative proceeding being one in civil nature is because you could find in Rule 803, subsection 8 of public record, and a report of the police agency is, I think where you and I are confusing it, or I am anyway, is it's hearsay when we try to present it in the criminal, underlying criminal proceeding.
Correct.
803.8 makes a specific exception where it says in criminal proceedings.
Correct.
So maybe that...
criminal proceedings, there would be a direct problem.
Yeah.
But insofar as this is not a criminal proceeding, as far as this is an administrative proceeding, I believe that we don't run afoul of the rules of evidence in the first place. I would also, again, emphasize that we can go throughout the jurisprudence of this court as far as rules and statutes interacting together to make some semblance and some sense of it all, that there are adjustments and interpretations that are available that do not exist in the actual situation in any way.
Thank you, Mr. Quinn. Mr. Song, you would take 30 seconds.
45 seconds. 30. Just for the driver, the ground machine analysis, clearly it's allowed with theoretical hearsay information, but the courts are taking judicial notice at that level of the action. As I say, radar guns can't be used. Well, they can be used because judicial notice can be used. I looked to see whether I had actually attached a copy of this report that we're talking about to my brief. I know I did not attach it to the brief for this court. I thought I did it in the Court of Appeals. It may be in your file somewhere. However, Mr. Christopher assures me that his copy of his similar ALF form that we're talking about was in fact presented to this court. It's in the appendix. It was pretty well buried in there. It's of some interest, the difference in the communities. In Akron, it merely says that Mr. Kirby, my client, committed a lane change, which gave rise to the problem of false hearing. In Hancock County, the officer advised that there was slurred speech, an accident, and something else that I can't read. Again,
thank you. Thank you. Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. The marshal, please adjourn court.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. Open session.